I want you to think back to your first day at your current job, or really any job you've had recently.
Oh, yeah, the classic IT waiting game.
Exactly. You show up, you're super excited, you've got your coffee, sit down at your desk, and then you just sit there for hours, sometimes like actual days.
Yeah.
You're just staring at a screen, waiting for IT to set up your email, your Slack, your access to the shared drives. I mean, it is an absolute rite of passage in the corporate world at this point.
It really is.
But I want you to flip that scenario around for a second. Have you ever had that really unsettling realization where you're scrolling through a company directory, or maybe you see a little green active dot next to a name in chat, and it hits you that, wait, this person left the company like 3 weeks ago.
Oh, yeah.
Their login still works, their access is completely live.
It is a surprisingly common occurrence.
Yeah.
You're basically looking at a digital ghost.
Right. Yeah.
And, it highlights a massive vulnerability that most people in an office just walk right past every single day without realizing how dangerous it actually is.
Which brings us perfectly to our mission today. Welcome to the deep dive. We are looking at a really comprehensive stack of sources today covering identity lifecycle management, specifically tearing down the mechanics of SailPoint provisioning versus deprovisioning.
Yeah, this is a big one.
It is. Our goal here is to understand the invisible gears that control exactly who gets access to what in a modern enterprise. Because, as the research clearly points out, this seemingly mundane IT task of, managing passwords and permissions, it's actually the absolute front line of corporate security today.
For sure.
Okay, let's unpack this. Provisioning is essentially like giving a brand new employee the master keys to the office building, handing them the corporate credit card, and giving them the alarm code on day one. And deprovisioning is making sure you get every single one of those things back the exact second they decide to quit.
I love that visualization actually, because it grounds a very abstract software concept into physical security. Because to understand why managing those digital keys matters so much right now, we really have to recognize a fundamental shift in how businesses operate today. The traditional network firewall is dead.
Wow, just dead.
I mean, it just doesn't exist in any meaningful way anymore. 10 years ago, you could put a digital moat around a physical office building, restrict all the work to the desktop computers inside that building, and just assume everything inside was generally safe.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But today, we have remote work, we have cloud applications hosted on third-party servers, mobile devices, external contractors, all of it. So identity is the new security perimeter.
Identity is the perimeter.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The boundaries of your company are no longer defined by a physical wall. They're defined by who has the credentials to log in. So managing these keys is not just some IT convenience feature to save time for the help desk. It is the core mechanism for protecting the business.
Okay, so if identity is the new perimeter, then the fundamental actions that manage that perimeter are handing out access and, tearing it away. The sources make a huge point of stating that these two actions, provisioning and deprovisioning, carry entirely different risk profiles. So let's start with provisioning, getting people the access they need.
Yeah.
The sources mention this can happen in a few different ways. Like there is HR-driven provisioning, which sounds pretty straightforward.
It is. The HR system is essentially the authoritative source of truth. When an HR manager types in, "Hey, we have a new hire starting Monday," that entry acts as an immediate trigger to the identity system to start creating accounts.
Got it. And then there is self-service, where you just put in a request for a specific app you suddenly need. But the one that really caught my eye is this concept of birthright access. What exactly does that mean in this context?
Well, think of birthright access as the baseline survival kit for an employee based strictly on their job title.
Okay.
So if you are hired as a graphic designer, your birthright access automatically grants you an email account, Slack, and an Adobe Creative Cloud license. If you are a financial analyst, your birthright access might be Excel, the financial reporting database, and the VPN.
Yep.
It is automatically assigned to everyone in that particular department or role, so they can just hit the ground running without asking for permission piece by piece. It's pure enablement.
Pure enablement. I like that.
Yeah.
So on the flip side of enablement, we have deprovisioning, removing or reducing that access.
Yeah.
And the sources break this down into full deprovisioning. So someone leaves, you shut off everything, and partial deprovisioning, which is interesting because it happens when someone just changes roles, right?
Exactly.
You move from finance to marketing, you get the marketing tools, but you really need to actively lose the finance tools. And this brings us to the core tension the sources highlight.
Yeah, what's fascinating here is the sheer asymmetry between these two processes.
Yeah.
It's an asymmetry in both urgency and visibility.
How so?
Think about the psychology of a business. Mm. Provisioning delays are what we call loud.
Yeah.
If a new hire cannot access their tools on day one, or a marketing manager can't get into the campaign software they need to launch a product, productivity literally stops.
Mm.
People complain. Managers escalate the issue up the chain immediately. The business feels the pain, and IT gets yelled at.
Right. Everyone notices.
Exactly. Deprovisioning delays, however, are entirely silent. No one notices if a departed employee's account is still active.
Well, why would they? I mean, the ex-employee is definitely not going to call the help desk to complain that they can still log into the company intranet.
Right. They just keep quiet.
It just sits there. But wait, if leaving these accounts open is such a massive security risk, why does deprovisioning get delayed at all? I mean, going back to my physical key analogy earlier, it's like moving out of an apartment, the landlord forgets to ask for the keys back and then just never bothers to change the locks.
It's exactly like that.
Why does it take a formal auditor or a literal hacker to find these accounts sitting open?
To understand that, we have to look at the legacy IT processes that, frankly, a lot of companies still rely on. In a traditional, non-automated setup, offboarding is just a mess of human memory and manual help desk tickets.
Just people trying to remember what to do.
Basically, yeah. Let's trace it. HR tells a manager that an employee is leaving. The manager is supposed to submit a ticket to IT. IT gets the ticket, and then an actual human being has to manually log into 10 or 20 different administrative consoles.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, like Salesforce, Microsoft 365, internal databases, just to disable the accounts one by one. Somewhere in that chain, a step gets missed.
Of course.
The manager forgets to mention the specific custom database the employee used. Or the IT person gets distracted by an urgent server outage halfway through their tech list.
And so you end up with what the sources call orphaned accounts. Active accounts that belong to a human who is literally no longer there.
Precisely. And orphaned accounts are a massive, well-known attack vector. A bad actor, whether that is a disgruntled former employee looking to do damage, or an external hacker who bought compromised credentials on the dark web, finds an orphaned account and uses it to walk right through that new identity perimeter we talked about.
Just walk right in.
Yeah. Because the company assumes the account is dead, no one is actively monitoring it for strange behavior. So the hacker has a massive window of vulnerability to explore the network, escalate privileges, and steal data, completely undetected.
That is genuinely terrifying. Just invisible open doors scattered all over the corporate network.
It really is.
So because human memory and manual IT tickets are so clearly failing to close those windows, the sources emphasize that organizations are forced to turn to structured automation. They specifically break down how a platform like SailPoint solves this problem by completely removing the manual ticket from the equation.
Right. And the foundational framework for that automation engine is what the industry refers to as the Joiner Mover Lever Lifecycle, or JML. Yes. This framework ties identity actions directly to business events rather than waiting for someone to submit an IT ticket.
Break that down for us mechanically. How does JML actually function when a company implements it?
Sure. Let's start with the joiner phase. A new employee is hired. The moment that record hits the HR system, the identity platform detects the update. It automatically provisions that birthright access we discussed.
Instantly.
Day one, minute one, the employee logs in and has everything they need. Then you have the mover phase. This is the partial deprovisioning we talked about.
Right, changing roles.
Exactly.
Yeah.
An employee is promoted or changes departments. The HR system updates their job title. The identity engine sees the change and automatically adjusts their access. It grants the new entitlements they need, but crucially, it instantly revokes the old access that is no longer relevant to the new title.
That's huge.
It is. And finally, the lever phase. An employee is terminated or quits. The HR status changes to inactive, and an instant, full deprovisioning command is fired across every single connected system simultaneously.
Now, the sources mention that this whole JML process heavily relies on something called RBAC, role-based access control.
Yes.
But they kind of gloss over the actual mechanics of it. What is RBAC actually doing behind the scenes here?
It's basically the logic engine that makes automation possible at scale. Instead of assigning individual permissions to individual people, like checking a box that says John Smith gets access to the client database, you assign permissions to a role.
Okay, that makes sense.
You create a role called Senior Sales Rep and attach the database permission to that role. When John Smith is hired, you simply assign him the role of Senior Sales Rep. He inherits all the permissions attached to it.
Ah, I see.
And when he leaves, you just strip the role, and all the associated permissions fall away instantly. It turns a tangled web of individual access rights into a really clean modular system.
The research also differentiates between deploying this on SailPoint Identity IQ versus Identity Security Cloud, which, you know, seems like an important distinction depending on how a company's infrastructure is built.
It is. Identity IQ is generally for organizations that have complex legacy on-premises infrastructure.
Like older banks or something.
Exactly. They have physical servers and highly customized applications that need a governance engine sitting right there on their own network.
Right.
Identity Security Cloud is their SaaS offering, designed for modern companies whose entire workflow is already in the cloud. But regardless of which deployment a company uses, that core JML logic remains exactly the same.
Wait, so SailPoint isn't actually holding all the data itself. It sounds like it's just the brain, and it needs hands to do the work. How do these connectors actually reach into systems like Workday, Active Directory, or Salesforce without human intervention?
If we connect this to the bigger picture,
yeah.
You have to look at the reality of a modern enterprise IT environment. It is sprawling and deeply heterogeneous.
That's everywhere.
Yeah, you have 50-year-old mainframe databases sitting right next to brand new cloud-based marketing tools. SailPoint acts as the central governance brain. The connectors are the bridge. They are essentially pre-built APIs or application programming interfaces that act as translators.
Translators for the code.
Exactly. SailPoint makes a policy decision. Revoke this user's access. The connector takes that generic command and translates it into the highly specific technical syntax required by Salesforce or SAP or Azure AD to actually disable the account in that specific software.
Oh, wow.
It is what allows a single central platform to manage identity across hundreds of disparate systems instantly. Without connectors, the brain can make all the decisions it wants, but you are still relying on a manual IT ticket to execute it. With connectors, the automation is executed end-to-end.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Once you establish that this automated brain in hand system actually works at lightning speed, you have to look at what happens if it executes a bad rule. Because getting this wrong isn't just an internal IT headache. A single permission error executed instantly by automation can lead to massive compliance fines or literal fraud. The sources dedicate a lot of time to segregation of duties, or SOD.
Yes, very important.
Let me use an analogy here to see if I have this right. You cannot be the person who writes the corporate check and the person who approves the corporate check.
Exactly.
If one single user has the access rights to do both of those actions in the financial software, you haven't just made a mistake. You have quite literally built a machine for embezzlement.
That is the absolute textbook definition of why segregation of duties exists as a concept. It is a fundamental internal control designed to prevent any single user from having conflicting access rights that could lead to fraud or catastrophic error.
Right.
When you automate provisioning, the governance engine doesn't just hand out access blindly. It checks every single access request against those SOD policies before granting anything.
The real-world applications of this in the sources are really intense. Like in financial services, banks use these automated SOD checks to enforce segregation between the people making trades and the people settling those trades.
Yes.
If the system detects a conflict, it just hard stops the provisioning.
And beyond finance, look at the healthcare examples in the research. Hospitals deal with life and death data.
Literally.
Yeah. They rely on rapid, automated deprovisioning to ensure that former nurses or doctors can no longer access electronic health records the exact minute their shift or employment ends. That isn't just best practice. That is a strict legal necessity for HIPAA compliance.
Wow.
Or take the retail sector. Large retailers have massive influxes of seasonal workers for the holidays. They use automated provisioning to onboard 10,000 temporary staff members on November 1st. And then they rely on automated deprovisioning to rip all that access away at midnight on January 15th when the seasonal contracts end.
That's crazy scale.
Doing that manually would require an absolute army of IT staff.
And tying all of those industry examples together is the massive shadow of regulatory compliance. It seems like the auditors don't just care if you are secure. They demand that you prove it with a paper trail.
That is the crucial shift in modern compliance. Regulatory frameworks expect you to prove that access is appropriate, time-bound, and actively governed.
Right.
Because platforms like SailPoint are fully automated, they automatically log every single action. They create a perfect, immutable audit trail.
So no more guessing.
Exactly. If you are dealing with SOX compliance, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, you have to prove strong controls over financial reporting systems. If you are dealing with GDPR in Europe, you have to prove you are minimizing access to personal data based on the principle of least privilege.
Meaning people only have access to exactly what they need.
And nothing more. Automated provisioning and deprovisioning naturally support these audits because the proof is generated automatically every time the system runs.
I am going to push back on this flawless automation narrative for a second, though.
Oh, go for it.
If the system is so smart and the RBAC policies are so tight and the connectors execute everything perfectly, why do the sources emphasize a process called access certification? Why do we still need human managers doing periodic reviews of what their team has access to if the automated brain is supposed to be handling the whole JML lifecycle?
Because human nuance is incredibly messy, and temporary situations arise that strict automation rules might not perfectly capture.
Okay.
Fair. Access certification is basically a safety net. It's a periodic review process, maybe quarterly or biannually, where a manager or a system owner is presented with a dashboard showing exactly who has access to their specific applications. They have to review the list and formally attest, yes, this access is still appropriate for this person.
What is an example of something automation would miss that a manager would catch during that review?
Well, let's say a marketing employee requested temporary access to a highly sensitive financial folder to pull data for a special two-week cross-departmental project.
Yeah.
The manager approved the request as an exception to the standard RBAC policy, but they forgot to put a strict expiration date on the approval.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, the automation engine doesn't know the project is over. It just knows the access was approved. 6 months later, that marketing employee still has access to sensitive financial data.
Right.
Access certification forces the manager to look at that list, spot the lingering entitlement, and click revoke. It catches the exceptions to the rule, reinforcing the need for continuous human governance right alongside the automation.
That persistent need for human oversight really highlights that even the best systems have blind spots, which points us directly toward the current challenges in the field and how this technology is failing in the real world when it isn't set up perfectly.
Yeah, it's not a magic wand.
The sources list a few common pitfalls. First is incomplete connector coverage. If an organization buys SailPoint but only hooks it up to, like, 80% of their applications, the other 20% are still relying on manual IT tickets.
Yep.
Suddenly, you have a massive gap in your automation. Another pitfall is overly broad birthright access, granting way too much default access on day one just to avoid help desk tickets, which totally undermines that principle of least privilege we just talked about.
The most dangerous bottleneck highlighted in the research, however, isn't a technical failure, it's a process failure.
Okay.
Delayed HR data feeds.
Walk us through how that actually plays out.
Well, remember that automation is only as fast as its trigger.
Right.
Imagine a scenario where a disgruntled employee is fired at 4:30 p.m. on a Friday. The manager handles the termination, but the HR department is rushing to go home for the weekend and decides, you know, they will officially update the central HR system on Monday morning.
Oh, man, I see where this is going.
Yeah. Because the HR system hasn't been updated, the automated deprovisioning engine hasn't received the lever trigger. The system still thinks the employee is active.
Yikes.
That fired employee goes home on Friday night, logs into the network remotely using their still active credentials, and spends the entire weekend downloading the client database, deleting shared files, and exporting sensitive company secrets.
Just a free-for-all.
That is a 60-hour window where a highly motivated, hostile actor has an orphaned account to play with. The company bought a $1 million automation system, but because of a manual HR bottleneck, it was completely useless.
So what does this all mean for you listening right now? It means that the next time you are stuck waiting 3 days for software access to do your job, you're not just dealing with a lazy IT guy ignoring your emails. You are likely the victim of a vague approval workflow, an incomplete connector to a legacy application, or a severe bottleneck in how your company's internal systems talk to each other.
Exactly.
Your frustration as an employee is a direct symptom of an identity governance failure at the enterprise level.
This raises an important question about where we go next. because the corporate landscape is only getting faster and more complex. The sources outline several major evolutionary shifts defining the future of identity lifecycle management.
Like what?
The first major shift is the move toward zero-trust security architecture.
I hear zero-trust thrown around as a buzzword constantly. How does it actually change provisioning and deprovisioning mechanically?
Historically, security operated on a trust-but-verify model. Once you were provisioned and logged in with the right password, the system basically trusted you for the rest of the session.
Right.
Zero trust, as defined by frameworks like NIST, demands continuous verification. It assumes a breach at all times. It's not a one-time approval at login, it's highly dynamic.
What does dynamic verification look like in practice?
Contextual monitoring. The system continuously evaluates the context of your access. Let's say you log in from your normal office in New York at 9:00 a.m. Access granted, but at 9:05 a.m., the system detects an attempt to download a massive, sensitive file using your credentials from an IP address in Tokyo.
Oh, wow.
Right. A traditional system might allow it because you are already logged in. A zero-trust identity engine detects the impossible travel time, instantly flags the context as high risk, and dynamically deprovisions your access to that file in real time until you can re-verify your identity through multi-factor authentication.
That requires an incredibly fast, automated engine analyzing massive amounts of data every second.
It does.
And to keep up with that processing speed, the sources mention the integration of AI-assisted access decisions.
Exactly. Human managers are already suffering from certification fatigue, just staring at endless lists of access requests.
I can imagine.
AI is stepping in to analyze the patterns. If an access request perfectly matches the behavior of 1,000 other employees in that role, the AI can predict it is low risk and just auto-approve it. It removes the friction for the routine stuff, allowing human managers to focus exclusively on reviewing the strange, high-risk requests that the AI flags as anomalous.
But the shift that completely blew my mind in the research is the massive growth of machine and non-human identities. We naturally think of provisioning as something you do for human employees. But today, organizations have to manage automated bots, API keys, and service accounts that scripts use to talk to databases.
The scale of this is staggering. These non-human identities need access to highly sensitive systems. They need to be governed by strict RBAC policies.
Just like humans.
Exactly. And most importantly, they absolutely must be deprovisioned when the script or bot is no longer in use. Otherwise, you leave a silent back door open into the network.
Right.
In many modern enterprise environments right now, non-human identities outnumber human users by orders of magnitude. It vastly expands the scope of what identity governance actually has to cover.
It is wild to think that IT departments are spending more time managing the permissions of software bots than actual people.
It's the new reality.
All right, let's bring this all together. What we've uncovered in these sources today is that provisioning gets employees moving fast. It is the ultimate business enabler. While deprovisioning keeps the organization secure long after that access is no longer needed, it is the ultimate risk reducer.
Perfect summary.
Together, they form the joiner-mover-lever backbone of modern security, replacing chaotic, error-prone, manual IT tickets with strict, policy-driven automation.
And for anyone navigating the corporate landscape today, whether you are an IT professional, a security analyst, or a business manager, mastering this intersection of security and enablement is crucial.
Definitely.
It is no longer just about basic IT hygiene. It is foundational to enterprise survival. The security gap between organizations using automated, identity-centric governance and those still relying on manual processes is widening rapidly. Understanding how these lifecycle mechanisms actually function is a massive career growth area because, as we established at the beginning, identity truly is the modern security perimeter.
It really is. And I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over, building on what we just discussed about the future.
Let's hear it.
If AI systems are eventually predicting and auto-approving access requests, and non-human bot identities already vastly outnumber human employees, what happens when an AI is entirely responsible for provisioning and deprovisioning other AI identities?
Oh, man.
If a machine goes rogue in the network and another machine is the one that evaluated the risk and gave it the master keys, where does the concept of human accountability even fit in? Who do the auditors blame? It's something to think about the next time you find yourself staring at your screen on a Monday morning just waiting for those keys.